You are listening to the Family Business Podcast, the podcast aimed at delivering insights to help your family business thrive. I'm your host, Russ Hayworth, and each week I'll be bringing you interviews from family businesses and their advisors from all over the world. So, without further ado, let's get on with the show. Hello and welcome to the Family Business Podcast. I'm your host, Russ Hayworth, and this week I'm joined again by Nick Smith, who you will have heard of in episode one. Now, me and Nick spend a little bit of time today talking about structure, and what we mean by that is when a business is set up, it's very often given a simple structure for a variety of perfectly reasonable reasons. But as your business grows and develops, those original structures may no longer be suitable, but are often overlooked. So we look at some of the common structures and some of the potential issues that arise with those and offer some solutions along the way. So we'll get straight into the chat with Nick and hope you enjoy it. Thanks very much. We often meet businesses who have established themselves as husband and wife teams who may or may not be feel they're in business together, but the corporate structure of the business is very much that they are in business together and that they have both got share ownership. They may have been to see an accountant who has told them that there are several tax advantages to owning a business in that way. So today we're going to explore that in a little more detail and try and understand that yes, there are advantages to it, but also to understand that there may be some unintended consequences for the business as it matures and grows. And to do that, I'm joined by Nick Smith, who you will have known from previous podcast episodes. I'll let Nick introduce himself briefly in a second, but we're just going to run through some of the advantages at a high level. We don't want to bore you with too much tax stuff, but then move on to have a chat about some of the other knock-on effects that the joint ownership may have. So hi there, Nick.
Russell, good morning.
Hiya. If you could just give our audience a whistle-stop tour of your career to date, and then we'll get into the content.
Okay, a whistle-stop tour is that I started off life as a lawyer about 30 years ago, working with a lot of family-owned businesses. About halfway through that career, I got particularly interested in the family-owned business, and I've devoted the second half of my career to specialising in family-owned business work. And over the last two or three years, I've given up law altogether and now practice as a family business consultant.
Great. So I imagine in your day-to-day work now, you regularly come across business structures that are in place purely because at the time the business was established, that made sense at the time to do so. And one that we see quite often is a 50-50 ownership between husband and wife.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of my first questions is, well, why is that? Why is the business set up this way with you each owning 50% of the business? Because from what I can see, it looks as though the outside world would identify a particular spouse, you know, historically a husband, as the face and driver behind the business. And the answer very often comes back to, well, that's what our accountant advised us to do X years ago for tax reasons. And, you know, you can't dismiss those tax reasons. There are two main ones. The first one, to maximise available income tax reliefs, essentially to spread the reward and the profit that would otherwise that's coming from the business equally between husband and wife, to make maximum use of nil rate bands, lower rate tax bands, and more recently, the ability to pay a few thousand pounds by way of dividend, essentially tax-free. Mm. You know, so that's money worth having.
Yeah.
The second reason is to do with capital gains tax and maximising entrepreneurs' relief. I mean, broadly speaking, if you have two actively involved partners in a business, you're getting £20 million worth of capital gain that will just be taxed at 10%. Mm-hmm. Having said that, realistically, how many of the businesses that we come across on a day-to-day basis mm-hmm. have the potential to be sold for a price tag of 20 million.
Absolutely. And at outset, they may feel as if the business is obviously going to be worth hundreds of millions of pounds. And others may not be looking for that kind of exit strategy, if you like. They may have completely different reasons for going into business together.
Yeah. I think we come back to the key question. We've probably talked about in on a number of occasions, which is, well, why are we going into business together? You know, are we going into business together as a husband and wife partnership? In reality, is it our business, or in reality, does it have the look and feel of your business? Mm-hmm. And the role of one of the spouses is much more as the supporter than the doer.
Yeah.
The Americans invented the word copreneur. Mm-hmm. It's actually, it sounds dreadfully American, but it's actually quite a useful concept. You know, the idea, are we in this together? Is this a cooperative, collaborative husband and wife, partner, collaboration, or is it actually your business? Mm. And I don't think it's not a binary question. You know, it isn't, yes, we are co-preneurs, no, this is your business. The way I see it is it's something like a scale. Mm-hmm. You know, one end of the scale, the partner does almost nothing in the business other than appear perhaps as a joint signatory on the bank account as a director and shareholder. The other end of the scale, you've got fully engaged husband and wife partnerships. I suppose the best example you can still come across of this, you know, on almost every high street in the country is the Body Shop.
Yeah.
You know, Anita Roddick was very much the face of the Body Shop, but her husband Gordon had a very, very prominent role in that business. Mm. And the look and feel of the Body Shop was very much of a co-preneurial, fully committed joint venture.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other points on the scale. Some things we come across reasonably often is the situation where there'll be one partner working full-time in the business, but the other will play very much a sort of supportive role. Mm-hmm. In effect, as a non-executive director in their own family business, you know, helping with strategy, providing support at difficult times, sometimes filling in and being that extra pair of hands when the business is that sort of exciting, all hands to the pump's growth stage.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that is a very valuable role. I suppose the key point is that it's something to be talked through and thought through.
Mm.
And for the couple concerned to think about, well, why are we doing this? What are our respective roles going to be? Mm. And to keep that under review alongside the tax advice.
Mm. And at the startup stage of a business, it may be difficult to understand fully what each of the spouses may be fulfilling, what roles they may be fulfilling within the business. Because it's a startup, because it's possibly just the two of them at that point, it may be that it's all hands on deck, and it requires a lot of involvement. And as the business matures, that involvement may decrease to a certain extent. Roles may change. They may bring people into the business to take some of the load off of the owners. And yet the what we typically see is the ownership structure that has been put in place is nearly always the same as when the business was first established.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. And I think you come back to the key point of the need to keep the business and its structures, its strengths, its weaknesses under pretty constant review. Mm-hmm. Larger families, third, fourth, fifth generation families, talk about things like family assemblies and family councils and all these sort of structures mm-hmm. that are designed precisely that, to sort of think about the relationship between the business and the business-owning family. Some of the more successful early-stage husband and wife partnerships that you come across adapt a similar philosophy. You know, that they have their family meetings, mm-hmm. but the family at this stage is simply the husband and wife.
Right.
You know, I've got clients that rigidly take time out once a year to have their family business meeting. Mm-hmm. Kids off to the grandparents, book a nice hotel for the weekend, but make sure that at least on the Saturday they have a good in-depth conversation about what's going well in the business, what the future looks like for the next year, what needs to change. Mm. And I think in that way, you're getting the best balance between what's good for the business and what's good for the family. Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about the early stage, you know, the all hands to the pump stage, and that's very exciting, in as much as licking envelopes at midnight can be. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of wonderful feeling, like between us we can take on and beat the world, we can beat the big boys if we get this mailing out. Then we can fulfill this contract, we'll drive through the night to make this delivery. All these sort of great entrepreneurial turning points, startup moments. But mm-hmm. there comes a time sometimes when you lean a little bit too much on that level of family support. Mm. Is that an indication, really, that the business isn't as profitable as it could be mm-hmm. or should be? And do we need to actually think a little bit more about ditching some of the unprofitable contracts, chasing revenue rather than profit, and build all getting in an appropriate level of non-family employee support, so that the family members can then be concentrating on building the business rather than scurrying around like a hamster in their wheel,
yeah.
doing everything hands on or 24 hours a day. Mm.
And it can be very tempting, kind of at the early stages, to take on any work because there is that revenue kind of target to it. There's that there's a feeling that there's money coming into the business, irrespective of the fact whether it's profitable or not. If there's no work coming in the early stages, and you get offered something that you wouldn't necessarily want to take on, but it's money, there's a temptation there to do it, isn't it? And that can put pressure under the or on the family unit if it's not a particularly profitable engagement.
Again, it's a question of balance. Yes, if you've got a completely empty order book and a job comes in that will pay the rent for the quarter, you'll be very, very brave to turn that down mm. on the basis that the next phone call may be a hugely profitable contract.
Yeah.
But again, I think you come back to the sort of support that the non-full-time working spouse can provide. Mm. just questioning key business drivers like profitability, like turnover, the sort of contracts, the marketing strategy. That's done in a sort of constructive, helpful way. That's exactly the sort of support that a non-full-time working spouse can be providing.
Yeah.
And that's fitting closer to the definition, you know, the full co-preneurship definition. That's feeling much more like my business, our business, than my business.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's some good examples of that, really. I mean, sometimes I say good examples, probably bad examples, where the opposite happens. And the spouse is, plays a purely supportive role. You know, they're very supportive in signing things like bank guarantees or guarantees for landlords, because typically husband knows best and are always being trusted to take care of the family finances.
Yeah.
There's one case where, in fact, this family ended up, the whole family ended up before the court in director's disqualification proceedings.
Crikey.
The husband was clearly going to be disqualified. It made a complete financial disaster of a property business. But he'd also asked both son, daughter, and wife to be co-directors, and because husband knows best, they'd sign the relevant forms. Business crashed and burned, and I think the husband had essentially admitted that if his wife had actually asked any business questions, he'd have spat his cornflakes out.
Right.
So. Yeah, there you've got the situation where it's difficult to see what contribution the wife was making to the business, but it got all the risk and all the burden of a full-blown directorship.
Yeah. And it's very difficult to question your spouse on things like that if it is a my business kind of environment, that it's my business, but you are named as a director or a shareholder for whatever reason. For the person who's then not involved in a business to say, are you sure this is the right thing to do? Firstly, if they're not involved in the day-to-day running of the business, they're not going to know that side of it. And secondly, you do get the reaction of, I know best, it's my business. You know, keep your nose out.
It's a very, very tricky and difficult dynamic. But I suppose you come back to the position that if you have a family involved in a business, even if the day-to-day involvement of the spouse, the children is minimal, they are nevertheless going to be impacted by the success or failure of that business. Mm-hmm. So again, I think it's probably originated over the Atlantic, the expression of stakeholder. Every family member, I believe, is a stakeholder in a family business. And therefore, I firmly believe every stakeholder has a legitimate right to have their interests considered and taken into account the way that business works. It comes down really to questions of family dynamics, and there is a big limit, a great limit to what any advisor can do to change the fundamental dynamic of husband and wife relationship.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not necessarily going to give out my home address. What I'm going to do is just give every spouse permission to be asking these questions. And I think this is what the annual meeting comes down to.
Yeah.
You know, if the conversations are in a sort of questioning, hostile environment. What time do you call this? Why are you still working this? We're not making any money out of this business at 11 o'clock after the working spouse has been in had a 15-hour day. It's not likely to go down hugely well.
No.
On the other hand, if you come back to this idea of the time out to be thinking about the business, how this is working for the family, and you're setting up the environment that for a constructive conversation, you've got a halfway chance of getting a good outcome.
Absolutely. And we quite often hear when we ask family businesses on their where do you discuss business ideas and where do you discuss the kind of progress, and a fair few answers come back as kind of around the dinner table of an evening or on a Sunday lunch. And in those kind of environments, there's distractions, aren't there? The kids might be throwing their food across the room. There may be, you know, music or television in the background. And so those environments aren't necessarily the best environments to be having those conversations in. So by setting aside time, specific time, to focus purely on the business and put the kind of distractions to one side, is really effective. And we do it within our business. We have a quarterly away day where we go and sit in a conference room in a hotel, and we focus purely on what the business is doing and why we're doing it, and are we still on track to do what we want to achieve. And every year we have 2 days out of the office where we do exactly the same thing. We look at the overall business plan, look at the strategy for the coming year, and then decide who's going to be doing what over the next quarter to get us closer to our ongoing targets. And that practice has really helped in pulling everybody within the business together on a vision. And it was introduced as a result of the guy I work with working with his dad and then not being able to have those discussions in any other kind of environment. So by specifically setting that environment up, the conversations were then there to be had. And I think communication is a massive tool in ensuring success of any business, but in particular those where family members are involved, because it's very easy to just say, well, we'll have a chat over dinner one night or over a glass of wine or whatever it may be. But formalising that structure, I think, is really important.
I think that's very interesting, because when you read a lot of the family business literature, they talk about, you know, the Sunday lunchtime board meeting and so forth, and it's often put over as a strength. And it can be, you know, the children, spouses, just an instinctive understanding of what the business is about. But I think you're right, it can also be a considerable weakness. And a lot of the thinking I've come across talks about trying to clearly differentiate between business time and family time. Yes. And doing your best not to mix the two, or at least being aware of when you are bringing family issues into the workplace, which is, you know, if you have husbands and wives working together, that is clearly a big risk. You know, you had a row about something on completely non-work related, haven't resolved it by the time you walk through the door. Boy, do any non-family employees know what's been happening.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not the detail, they just know.
They just know, yeah.
Equally, a bad day at the office, which everybody has, can translate and affect children. It can affect the couple. And there are, we've talked about it on other occasions, but If children have a negative experience of what it's like to be in a family business, your husband and wife come back, they're always rowing about something or other business related. turn around in 20 years' time and wonder why the children don't want to come into the family business.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like just grown up with a very negative image of it. Now, one tip I've come across is, doing the best to separate business life and family life, but also trying to be aware of this sort of crossover, I think they're described as liminal zones, mm-hmm. where one partner may be, let's say, in a home environment, but the other partner is still in mentally a business zone.
Mm-hmm.
They're wanting to talk about business at home. And the other partner sort of picks up, almost has defense mechanisms, like picking up newspapers, starting to prepare the supper.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that indicate they've crossed over into the other space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's developing an awareness of those little signals, and ideally supplemented by family business rules that can make the difference between success and failure, not only of the family business, but also of the relationship. Mm,
absolutely, which brings us on, I guess, to some of the potentially negative connotations of shared ownership of a business. When there's relationship breakdown, so separation or divorce. We have historic cases where husband and wife were advised to go into business together, set it up 50-50. Wife had absolutely no involvement in the business, but was able to take an income and did some admin roles for that purpose. Business matured, and after 20 or so years, there was a divorce. Husband was under the assumption that because he was the one working full-time in the business, that business asset was solely his. Yet the shareholders' agreement and the share ownership was 50-50. So obviously that asset then forms part of any potential divorce proceedings. And whilst we don't want to be doom and gloom about relationship breakdown, it's something that happens. It's something that is becoming more common. So perhaps we can have a little chat around the implications of a divorce on the family business ownership.
It's an interesting point. And what I don't know is whether couples involved in a family business are more or less likely to divorce than other couples. I've not come across any research to that effect.
No.
I mean, I think you can probably make guesses in both directions, really. I mean, certainly some of the pressures involved may point towards a greater propensity to divorce. But some of the good stuff, like the excitement of building a business together, working together to create something, the work-life balance and escaping the corporate world and all the rest of it, may mean that a good husband and wife family business is good for both the business and the family.
Yeah, absolutely.
I suppose the other, I'll get on to some negatives soon, honestly, but the other positive is that there's a working assumption, I think, that if the end of a matrimonial relationship would mean the end of the business relationship, but it ain't necessarily so.
Mm.
Certainly come across one household name business, in fact, where the business manager of this, it's public knowledge, Vivian Westwood.
Mm-hmm.
Vivian Westwood's business manager for years was her ex-husband,
mm-hmm.
and they worked wonderfully well together. Did a little bit of work with them as business partners, even though their personal relationship had finished many years earlier.
Mm.
But getting back to your question, what happens on divorce? I suppose you can't get away from the basic point that the courts have a pretty wide discretion about the reallocation of assets on divorce. But of course, if they have to start from somewhere, and if that starting point is a 50-50 ownership, and the husband wants to take the view that, you know, the business is his, he's got some talking to do.
Mm.
Equally, if the wife may not want the business, and being very stereotypical here, we're assuming that it's the husband driving the business, the wife not, that's changing. But the non-working spouse may actually not want the business. They may regard the business as, you know, they're tying up assets in an illiquid investment.
Mm-hmm.
They're bearing all the business risks. They're having very little by way of control over what's happening in the future direction of the business. So they may very much prefer the opposite solution. In other words, taking a greater share of the non-business assets like the matrimonial home,
mm-hmm.
pensions, any investments. So
yeah.
It's probably a bad starting point.
Mm.
You also mentioned shareholders' agreements. I find that absolutely fascinating.
Mm.
The firstly, statistically, the proportion of family business people with full-blown shareholders' agreements is pretty small.
Yeah.
And I suspect that the proportion of husband and wife early stage, first generation family businesses with full-blown shareholders' agreements is even
minimal,
even smaller.
Yeah.
But let's assume that there is a shareholders' agreement. Why wouldn't it have exit provisions?
Mm-hmm.
What do we think ought to happen in, let's say, not the foreseeable circumstance of divorce, but the possible circumstance of divorce? What do we, as we're living, breathing, in love with each other, in love with the possibilities of the business, think ought to be happening?
Yeah.
Now, if you can agree it at that stage, I suspect you're going to get a much more solid starting point.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you can always go somewhere different by negotiation. The courts will intervene. If what was agreed 20 years ago is clearly inappropriate, but at least you've got somewhere to go,
mm-hmm.
other than potentially banging heads, locking horns.
Absolutely. And I think in the startup phase, you're absolutely right that as little cost and framework that needs to be put around the business, the better in a lot of cases, because it's a startup, there's not loads of money sloshing around to be able to put all these formal structures in place. I guess the other thing at that stage is, with the excitement of a new business and the exciting possibilities, and you don't necessarily want to talk about divorce and certainly things like death as well. We come across many businesses where one spouse has sadly passed away, and there's been no provision at any stage of allowing for the fact that that may happen. And that's because in the early stages you don't want to think of things like that, and that's something that needs to be a consideration at some point. But when is that point? Because as you're starting the business, you want to just get going and have minimal cost at that stage. And then you get into the running of the business where you're busy, you're doing things to make the business a success. And those kind of priorities get shifted to one side, other than from, say, professional advisors who are saying, you should have this, you should have that, you should have this. And you're like, well, actually, I've got a business to run. I want to focus on that side of things rather than spending thousands of pounds on putting a piece of paper in place.
It's a difficult one, isn't it? And I guess it comes down to proportionality and priorities and communication.
Mm.
You're absolutely right. There are some subjects that are inevitably difficult to discuss. I suspect that the most successful couples are most successful family businesses, of those that find a way of dealing appropriately and proportionately with the potential taboo subjects, mm-hmm. like death, divorce, dispute, and just find a way to, well, look, it may happen. If it does, this is what we'll do. Let's move on.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably a link to the idea of taking some time out, to look at, and really just seeing it as a sort of species of business risk planning.
Absolutely.
And there's probably also a way of dealing with things proportionately. You talk about thousands of pounds, putting together shareholders' agreements, the paperwork, and yes, it can, to do an absolutely full job, it can cost that. But what's to stop an early stage family business getting hold of some stuff off the internet, buying some books, mm-hmm. having a little read and think about it, and putting together their own early stage shareholders agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, if this business fails or our marriage fails, this is what we think should happen. The working spouse takes over the running of the business, let's say an 80% ownership. They consult with a non-working partner on key business decisions that could affect the risk profile and any other non-matrimonial assets, like taking on more borrowing, mm-hmm. charges, etc. And if the business is sold within 5-10 years of the relationship split up, there's some sort of uplift in purchase price.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a prescriptive, this is what you should say. Mm. It's just an illustration that, effectively off the top of my head, we managed to come up with a shareholders agreement that could be written down in let's say an hour by the parties themselves.
Absolutely, without the overhead cost of having to employ legal teams to do so.
Can do that, as you say, in 5 years' time, after the fifth annual family assembly of husband and wife together, when they realise that actually it's worth putting a bit more paper in place because their business is now worth 5-10 million.
Mm. And the hotels they're staying in are far better than the...
Oh, it's now a 5-star hotel.
Yeah, not the Travelodge.
Probably for a small fee, you could probably hire somebody from the business services suite to write it all down for you.
Absolutely, yeah.
Not sure many hotels actually have family business advisors on hand for these purposes.
No, maybe they should.
They should, yeah.
Excellent.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? I think there's always a danger when you talk about husbands and wives, partners being in business together, of focusing on the negative.
Mm.
What I hope has come over in our conversation is that there are a huge number of positives.
And, absolutely, yeah.
A great potential for excitement of husbands and wives, partners working in business and building the next body shop together.
Absolutely.
Let's just conclude with a Freud's approach. I think what he said was that the two key ingredients for a happy life were love and work,
mm-hmm.
Leben and Arbeiten, and yeah, let's just work on the basis that husband and wife's in business together have the potential to get both in the same place.
Absolutely, yeah.
The best family business offer, two for the price of one.
Yeah. Great stuff. Thank you, Nick.
Well, that's it for this week. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you have done, please feel free to leave us a review on iTunes. It helps us be seen by more people. And we will be back next week with some more insights. If you want to get in touch with us, the best way to do so is via Twitter. We are at FamBiz Podcast, or we do have a contact us section on the website, which is www.fambizpodcast.com. We'll see you soon.